One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
What's up out there, friends and family, and thanks again for listening to us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, the man with no cool nickname, and across the table from me, the master of angry water, Kyle Big Fizzy Filson.
Hello! I'm here. I'm glad to be here. Playing with the soundboard, yes.
Pounding angry water.
It's pretty cool. All these buttons here, I like to fidget. If you're a fan of the show for the last 5 years, you know I like to fidget, and sometimes I mess things up.
Sometimes.
Most of the time.
There
Still
you go.
Shocked after all this time that the show comes out sounding as good as it does. I get asked that all the time. Where did you go to, like, recording school? We didn't. We watched YouTube, folks.
That's right. That's right.
Made a lot of mistakes.
Hey, I had said on the Elite show that I was going to do some of the, since we've got a lot of folks that have kicked up and been playing the angry water, the sparkling LaCroix and all this stuff with us, and been sending us links to different ones to try and all this. And I was going to talk about the tweets whenever people were hating on LaCroix, right?
Yeah, and I saw that some woman sent us a link to LaCroix swimming trunks.
The swim trunks, and we're getting them.
I want to get those. That, man. That looks awesome.
We're for sure getting some of those. So I'm going to read you some of these before we even get the show started to get everybody in the right mindset for LaCroix. I'm going to toss some of these out here. So these were off of Twitter where people were tweeting about them. And I had covered this one. This one is one from Twitter that says, LaCroix is like drinking Sprite with a condom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's pretty funny. One is, LaCroix tastes like the only soft drink they'd allow in a dystopian future where no one is allowed to have emotions. You'll like this one, Kyle. LaCroix tastes like someone ate a fruit salad and then burped into your water bottle.
I agree with that. Yeah.
I like this guy's tweet. Johnny Sun at Johnny Sun tweets out, LaCroix tastes like my ability to retain information for exams if the exam I'm studying for is what certain fruits taste like.
That's a good one.
At Bridget_W tweets out, I feel like LaCroix is what juice would taste like to a ghost.
That's a good one.
Mike Ingram 00 tweets, I guess the question I have for people who love LaCroix is, have you tried any other beverages?
Yeah.
He also tweets out that LaCroix tastes like it was made by a society in which flavor is the scariest natural resource, or scarcest, I'm sorry, natural resource. Now, this is one of my faves. There's a couple of them here, but this is a really good one. At Andrew Nadal 00. Every LaCroix flavor tastes like it was created by someone who didn't want to admit he'd never tasted fruit, so had a friend quickly describe it to him.
Those are funny. But look, LaCroix and the other Angry yes. Water, it's an alternative to soda. I never said it was taste the best. You know,
well, here's another one that says that it tastes like your office mate is putting lotion on. One here is, this is probably the best one. LaCroix is the kale of the beverage world. So I like LaCroix. Kyle is now fully addicted. Now he's got, we talked about it on the Elite Show, he's got an additional refrigerator in his garage where you would think people would keep beer. And there is a few beers, cans of beers in there. But the majority is boxes of different types of sparkling water.
I'm on a quest, and I've been researching, and like every store I can, I will buy different brands. I even have it delivered. Like if you listen to an Elite Show or two ago, I had some new Ozarka sparkling water delivered. I had orange.
Do you go on Amazon and search this stuff up and have them send you one?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just to try it out. You're just like, to try I got to have it here.
I got to know. In fact, a lot of the like basic shopping of our house, like the things you always need, like toilet paper, paper towels, light bulbs, simple things that you know that you need, like we order all that off Amazon. Like there's like
It's just easier.
Like before you'd have to be a member of like Sam's or Costco or something, and you would drive over there and you'd fill the vehicle full of groceries because you know you got discounts for buying in bulk. Man, I'm telling you, you can do it on Amazon in 2 days, that stuff's there.
You don't have to worry about it.
Now, of course, like your meat and your fresh food, your vegetables, you want to pick that out. I try to do a lot of this stuff at like farmers markets. Yeah, it's a little more expensive, but I'm telling you, man, it tastes way better.
We have an awesome farmers market here. Ours is amazingly awesome.
Yeah, and you go up there, I'm telling you, I know you don't like tomatoes, but I do.
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
You get your vegetables up there, man, and it's way better.
Hey,
way better.
I got to read this to you.
Okay.
Now, this had come from Lon over there at Phantoms and Monsters that he had actually received this. And it reminded me of a story that you and I were told the first time we had gone to Arkansas for the Eureka Springs, that Ozark Mountains.
Ozark Mountain UFO Conference.
We had talked about something that had happened to a fellow there in Afghanistan. And I want to read this to you because, folks, this is I always think about these things that could possibly be going on over there that maybe we don't know about or it's in a place of conflict. It's very interesting. But this is what it starts off saying, and follow along with me here. It says, I am a member of the United States Army, and I have a personal experience to share that comes from my deployment in Afghanistan. Due to the nature of my service, I cannot and will not share anything that will breach any level of OPSEC or InfoSec in any way, shape, form, or reveal any details that will or can be construed as such to compromise any operations myself and other members of the U.S. military conduct on a daily basis. That being stated, here's my story. I am a U.S. Army Infantry Squad Leader, a non-commissioned officer with 10 years in service, and I have 12 soldiers under my command in my squad, 10 soldiers and 2 non-commissioned officer team leaders. My soldiers are ranked E3 to E4 with 18 months experience at the very least, with my team leaders having 4 and 5 years experience respectively. All of us have at least one combat deployment together, with the senior of my soldiers having 2. All of us have enough experience in our service that we are absolutely confident in our abilities and skills as infantry soldiers, and know what to do and how to do it given any and all combat situations we encounter. So, when we are given a mission as a squad separate from our platoon, we did not really give any thought to the nature of the orders or the fact that we would be a significant distance from our platoon or any ground assistance whatsoever. Separate from any CAS or ARTY, A-R-T-Y, that we could call on and other assets available. I received the mission, issued the warno, made a plan, initiated movement, gathered recon, and completed the plan. I issued the op ord, and we all Oscar Mike'd. All the making and appearance of a usual and routine mission, something we did daily and completed daily. And then we reached the objective, and it all went to what I can only describe as hell given form. We had vehicles that were specifically designed for being explosive resistant and armored enough to give us an edge in surviving a multitude of situations we could come across. It was dark, and we have NVGs on. I'm sure that's night vision goggles. This is approaching a small village, 7 buildings, under the cover of darkness, being as quiet as possible, ready for anything. It says, we entered and cleared house after house and found bodies. A lot of bodies. So many, it was hard to enter any dwelling without stepping on any of them. And I have never, in 10 years, seen anything as disturbing or as shocking as the condition the bodies were in. And the sheer number was numbing to behold. Some looked as if they were ripped or torn in half. That is no mistake of typing or description. I literally mean torn or ripped by sheer brute strength. Some looked crushed, as if a ton or more of weight was slammed into them. And I mean pulped. I have run other human beings over with my 6-ton vehicle, and I know crushed when I see it. And others looked as I would expect if I were to eat a piece of raw meat with my teeth. If I had teeth like a shark or some sort of carnivore. Yeah. So now saying this, like something had taken a big damn chunk off of them and kept going, and the rest looked like what I would imagine some sort of mythical monster or something with claws or teeth or sharp anything would have went through them, so much like defenseless flesh all at once. We finally reached the end of the village and met something I can only describe as the closest to demonic as human language can make it, and it was terrifying. Thinking about it as I type this give me chills, making my heart feel like it'll burst from my chest and that any moment that thing will burst from somewhere and do unspeakable things to me before it kills me, ripping me apart like a rag doll full of flesh and blood. I still have nightmares about it. The first vehicle opened up on it with the 50 cal APT, and it was going cyclic. Next thing I know, I see a 6-ton armored vehicle that can take up to 80 pounds of explosive force come back rolling, literally fly, not roll, not flip, fly. It landed in the middle of the village in pieces. 6 tons of armor flew 700 meters. My vehicle was next, and I have never cycled an automatic grenade launcher so fast in my whole career. I was linking belt after belt after belt, and I was unjamming it almost as fast as it jammed. And I'm screaming my head off on the radio at the same time, trying to get a hold of my other vehicle. Call in Cass or Artie, and ordered my squad to shoot the damned thing with every weapon we have. Even though I know for a fact that all we are doing it anyway, that's so everybody's shooting.
Yeah.
He says, and I'm just screaming at this whole time. He says, I can hear screaming and gunfire and some other that sounds like it's a million voices screaming with us. There's explosions and tearing metal, absolute chaos in the control here. And I'm screaming, I'm crying, I'm praying. And then the craziest thing happened. Everything went absolutely silent. No sounds, no voices, no gunfire, no explosions, nothing. The world went mute. And after that, everything slowly came back. My alpha team leader, who climbed up to me, had to slap me hard to snap me out of whatever hellish zone I was in. My best guess is shock, but unlike anything I've ever heard, experienced, or watched. It took hours for me to get it together and start attempting to control the situation. Get communications with the LT, come to grips. First priority was the first vehicle. We could not raise them on the comms, so I sent two of us to go see if they were alive or needed medical attention. Then I realized that we didn't get a BDA on the thing we just unloaded on. I directed my driver to get close to the area, and I noticed something right off the bat. There was damage everywhere except for one spot. And in that spot was untouched and pristine, like it had never been subject to all the firepower we had directed at it. Not a single impact. And there was no sign of this thing anywhere, not even a footprint. I've been deployed 7 times in 10 years, and I have never seen anyone or anything walk away from that much firepower, ever. I know for a fact that no human on this earth could. 5 soldiers in the first vehicle lived, miraculously, due to the cab being reinforced, but suffered severe blunt force trauma from impact enough that all 5 in the vehicle were immediately given medical discharge and 100% disability a few months later. My other soldiers are all receiving the best psychological care possible. I am undergoing psychological evaluation as well due to the report I gave to my command. The treatment given to me and my squad is no surprise. However, the way my report of the incident was handled and what happened after is very confusing and very frustrating. No more about this has been mentioned or acknowledged again. I do not care if someone believes me anymore, as every time I am asked about it and answer, I am met with reactions of disbelief or pity and sympathy for my, in quotes, damaged mental state. I am even attempting to be cleared to continue my service and am forced to lie to my counselors and therapist about my progress in recovering from my experiences. I'm still haunted by this incident, and it still gives me a racing heart just thinking of it. I am hoping you share this with all the people and everything that you know, and I want to be anonymous. You can refer to me as Sarge, if anything. Even if you do not think you of any way of anything of reading this, but thank you for allowing me to send this to you, as I do not get anyone I know outside of my former squad to listen and believe me. Thanks again, Sarge. So, did they run across a djinn?
That's what I was thinking. I was going to say, it sounds like a djinn.
How terrifying would that be?
And it also reminds me of a couple years ago, we had a listener write in a story. Remember, they were out at patrol at night, and they had, like, night vision goggles on, and they saw that thing.
That emaciated or emanciated or whatever, the real skinny thing?
Yeah, right? So, I don't know.
Well, what keeps setting it out in my mind is, and you remember we had talked about, like I said, the story we had heard from the bartender up there that had served, was telling us about the stuff he had seen in Afghanistan. And then we find out, you hear the stories about the giant that they had killed in Afghanistan or whatnot over there. It makes you wonder, when you have guys like this, and of course, you know, we're going off with the idea that this is all true, that everything that he told us is on the up and up. If you have hardened combat veterans, it takes a lot to wind those guys up.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a real good friend of ours that had been deployed several times, you know, was retired from the military, but he was in combat quite a bit in the teams. So it was a specialty, not just a normal, you know, run-of-the-mill infantry or whatnot, but like specialty teams work. And it takes an awful lot to get him wound up. You know, nothing really seems to get him fired up. So you can only imagine, that's what I'm kind of judging myself, is you can only imagine what it would be like for him to tell you, you can't believe what happened to me this last time.
I know.
So something like that, it would be, but...
And people, you know, they're taking pity on, they're like, oh man, poor guy's got post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm sure he's hallucinating this, you know, poor guy.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, man.
Like, no, dude.
I really saw it, man.
Yeah. That it's a legit thing. So yeah, it's a disturbing deal, but I love the stories that come out of there like that, where these guys, like we said, something about it just feels more solid when I have a combat veteran telling me these stories.
I'm with you. Check this out. You're going to like this. I saw these two different articles, and they're very similar. They're talking about the same thing. But what grabbed my attention was the articles, the titles. And the first one was from the Science News, and its title was Octopuses Came to Earth from Space as Frozen Eggs Millions of Years Ago. And the second was from Cosmos.com. It says, Viruses, ET, and the Octopus from Space. The Return of Panspermia. So I had to check it out. And there's a really interesting article on Cosmos.com. And they actually cited a paper in this peer-reviewed journal. Cam, I know you get a copy of this. The Progress in Biophysics and Molecular Biology. And this article, this paper, in other words, was co-authored by 33 researchers from a wide range of reputable universities and research institutes. And the paper makes a seemingly incredible claim that life, the paper argues, did not originate on planet Earth. Now, you've heard about this before. This is much like when they talk about mushrooms coming from outer space, that fungus can survive the vacuum of space, right?
Mm-hmm.
The paper itself, which is available online, explores a couple of the evolutionary mysteries and attempts to solve them using the theory of panspermia. Now, that's what that is, the idea that life has spread throughout the universes via comets, asteroids, meteorites, that type of thing. And one focus of the paper is on complex retroviruses that emerged at or just before the Cambrian explosion around 500 million years ago, which are known to be associated with major evolutionary genomic processes. But the second thing that the paper focuses on is the remarkable evolution of intelligent complexity in cephalopods, like the octopus. And it ties these two anomalies together using microorganism fossil evidence contained within meteorites, as well as detection in the upper atmosphere of apparent incoming life-bearing particles from outer space. They say that we may have been seeded here on Earth by life-bearing comets as soon as conditions on Earth allowed it to flourish about 4.1 billion years ago. And living organisms such as space-resistant and space-hardy bacteria, viruses, more complex eukaryotic cells, fertilized ova and seeds have been continuously delivered to the Earth ever since. Now, it's the second part of the focus that's the most that I find the most interesting, because we talk about cephalopods on this show quite a bit. And in section 13 of the paper, which has made headlines in the media, of course, from, you know, crappy tabloid newspapers to genuine science magazines, but the researchers here note that octopuses appear to have suddenly diverged genetically from their ancestors, making a sudden great leap forward. They talk about its large brain and its sophisticated nervous system, its camera-like eyes, its flexible body, its instantaneous camouflage via the ability to switch color and shape are just a few of the striking features that appear suddenly out of the evolutionary scene. And after discussing some of the genetic data, the researchers then suggest that these genetic jumps seem to be borrowed from a far distant future in terms of terrestrial evolution, or more realistically, from the cosmos at large. But they're not just talking about a virus traveling to Earth from space. They instead amazingly suggest this, Cam, that cryopreserved squid and octopus eggs arrived in icy bodies several hundred millions of years ago, and that theory should not be discounted, as that would be, you know, ridiculous. So they're saying that around 270 million years ago, there was a sudden jump in cephalopods that they can't really figure out how that happened. That instantaneously, out of nothing, out of the muck, all of a sudden there was this octopus with the ability to change colors and all these things. And they're thinking, much like we talked about earlier with the fungus, that perhaps squid or octopus eggs somehow got on a asteroid or comet or something and was cryopreserved, traveled through space, landed on Earth, the environment was correct for it to flourish, and the Earth was populated by octopuses. So, in other words, they think that octopuses and squid could be aliens.
Is octopuses a word?
No, that's not a word.
Is it supposed to be octopi?
I think so, yeah.
I'm like, because you're making me crazy. Like, I'm thinking, deers? I'm sitting over here, I'm like, is that a word?
Look at all those deers. Yeah, no, it's octopi. But you know what I mean?
I'm not surprised. I really am not surprised, dude. They don't feel like they're from here.
If you were to take an animal from the animal kingdom that seems most like what you think an alien might look like, would you not say a cephalopod? I mean,
yeah, I would. Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
And they're highly intelligent. You've seen the videos of crawling out of fish tanks. And
I go down that rabbit hole often.
Unlocking
still.
Doors. Yeah. And man, what would an alien look like if one came here? Maybe it's an octopus.
Well, and what was it we were talking about, too, is you remember, like, they had that camera on that one where they kept saying that certain fish were disappearing in that one aquarium.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they were like, we don't know where they're going. And they finally had to put a camera up, and it would, the octopus would get out, or the squid would get out.
It'd wait till the person left.
Everybody was gone. Go across the floor, climb up, eat those fish, and then go and get back in his.
Yep.
I'm like, dude.
And have you seen the way they've escaped through super small holes?
Yeah.
They were able to manipulate locks.
How they can unscrew themselves out of a jar?
Yeah.
It's disturbing.
It's just, man.
Yeah.
I think that
that's what they ought to make it. You want to make a good alien movie now? Make it where it's a cephalopod.
Well, what was the movie Arrival? I don't remember the girl's name.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
And they go up there. Those creatures kind of resemble octopus.
Yeah.
Right?
The octopi.
Very interesting. Well, let's take a break, folks. And when we get back from the break, I'm going to be talking about ancient cultures that came up with technologies way ahead of their time. So stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Music. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
One of the things we like to talk about on this show is ancient history, ancient cultures from long ago, and the fact that there might have been a very sophisticated technological group of humans thriving on this planet eons ago that somehow met their end with almost nothing left to hint at their existence. Stories of Atlantis and ancient ruins that have been found in places like Göbekli Tepe, Nan Madol, Pumapunku, and advanced Stone Age cave systems all suggest that our ancestors were way more advanced than we give them credit for. They had intercontinental trade routes. We know this because of Egyptian carvings depicting corn. Well, corn only comes from the Americas, yet there they are, carved on the walls in Egypt. They had advanced surgery, including eye surgery, long before history says that they should have. I think the ancient world was much like it is today. We have modern cities, air travel, the internet, and podcasts, but at the same exact time, right now, there are indigenous tribes living in the wild jungles and other far-off places that have none of these things. So, just like we exist at the same time, couldn't our ancestors have lived in a similar way, where some cultures were very advanced and others were more like hunter-gatherers? I think so. The human race is remarkably resourceful. In our modern lives, we have figured out how to avoid all types of detrimental circumstances. How to stay warm in the winter. How to stay cool in the summer. How to refrigerate food. How to store and preserve food. How to avoid illness, storms, predators, and even hair loss. You have to sit back and wonder, what did the ancients know? What technological advancements have been lost to time? What were they capable of? So, on today's show, let's take a look at some of the technologies the ancients had that were way ahead of their time. Let's start off with one of the most famous archaeological finds on the subject. Discovered in the 1930s in a region called Kajut Ruba'a, just outside of Baghdad, the so-called Baghdad Battery was a wonder to behold, considering that electricity and its uses would not have been discovered for 2,000 years after these batteries came into existence. How did they know how to make these things? What led them to their discovery? The batteries discovered consisted of a clay jar and an asphalt stopper. Through the center of the stopper ran an iron rod that was surrounded by a copper cylinder inside of the jar. Now, it is believed that if the jar was filled with an electrolytic solution like vinegar or lemon juice, the battery would be able to produce at least 1.1 volts of electricity. Now, a volt may not be enough to power a home or a machine that relied on electricity, but archaeologists and historians believe that it may have been used for purposes of electroplating, since many artifacts with very thin layers of gold and silver have also been unearthed in some of these digs. Artifacts that may reinforce the notion that the batteries were ancient power tools. Now, of course, on the other side of the spectrum, some experts disagree that the Baghdad batteries are, in fact, batteries, since they found no conclusive evidence as to where they might have been used or what they might have been used for. Some scholars claim that the jars were more likely to be a sophisticated means of keeping scrolls and papyri, and that the acid residue found at the bottom of the clay jars was nothing more than decomposed scrolls and papyri. Whatever the claim, the Baghdad batteries still confound and astound historians and archaeologists to this very day. Well, when you think of the Baghdad battery, one of the things you may think of is what could they use it for? And I have to think of possibly light bulbs. For many of you, you may not know that in the Great Pyramids, you know, there's lots of carvings down these deep, dark tunnels inside of the pyramid. Well, they go so far down that, or inside, that there's a lack of oxygen. And there's such a lack of oxygen that it would be hard to even keep a torch going or a lamp. So, the question has always been, if you can't have a torch or a lantern or a candle or something for light, then how did they do the carvings? It's, you know, it would be pitch black in there and there's not enough oxygen to keep the fire going. But I guess there's enough to breathe. They have a couple theories on how did they light the inside of it. Now, one of the theories is that they used an elaborate scheme of mirrors where they would put all these mirrors refracting light all the way from outside of the sun down the tunnels. They would bounce them back and forth all the way down into the inner chambers, the inner sanctums of the pyramid, so that it'd be a light lit up enough so that the carvers could carve these reliefs into the walls. But another theory happens to deal with the Baghdad batteries. In fact, they think that the Baghdad batteries might have been used to actually light bulbs. And this brings me to the Dendera light. Now, the Dendera light is a particularly controversial topic since it's not exactly an artifact of potential ancient technology, but the possible depiction of an artifact on a wall of one of the best preserved ancient temples in Egypt, the temple of the Egyptian goddess Hathor at Dendera. Now, the Dendera light is found on three stone reliefs, and at first glance, could be construed as a lamp with a cable at the end and a snake-shaped cord inside. A priest is holding the lamp at one end, and a few smaller figures are below it, with one appearing to hold the lamp upwards. So, the Dendera light is more of an idea than it is an actual artifact. They've never actually found it. But that is an odd carving on the walls there, where I have to admit, it does look like they're holding a giant light bulb, and inside the glass bulb is the filament and everything. It does look like that. So that's one of the theories, is that they were using these Baghdad batteries or something much larger than the Baghdad batteries to actually create light bulbs, and that they had electricity even way back in ancient Egypt. And I know that Christopher Dunn, who's a researcher and author, and he's written some books about the ancient technologies of the Egyptians. Now, one of his theories is that the Great Pyramids were actually like a power source, like a nuclear generator or something that was used. But that's kind of a far out theory. But one of the things that is compelling is Christopher shows that some of these carvings, and I think one of them is like a statue that's carved, and it's like perfectly symmetrical. I mean, perfect. And but then he shows, like, on the back side of it, there appears to be tool marks. And I'm not talking about like hand tools. Like, this looks like a power tool is being used. And one of his theories is that they did have electricity back then, and that they actually had some crude forms of power tools. And when he shows you all the photographic evidence from several trips there to Egypt of where these electric, you know, appearing to be electric tool marks, man, it is kind of hard to argue. It does look like somebody was using a power tool and then slipped a little bit, and then they tried to cover it up a little. I don't know. But whether it was electricity or all done by hand, the fact that they were so accurate, the fact that they could pull that off, so symmetrical. I mean, you have to take your hat off to them. I mean, it's amazing. But moving back on, let's move over to the Greece. The Greeks, you know, they were pioneers on almost anything you can conceive of that helped build Western civilization. And among those was the technology for central heating. Yeah, now it may sound trivial and inconsequential when compared to the Grecian contributions, you know, to mathematics and science and things like that, like philosophy. But the idea of such a technology is quite remarkable, given that even the concept of it is something unheard of at the time. That's right, like central heat and air. Of course, not the air, but central heating. Called by the ancient Greeks as hypocaust or underburnt, the technology was first employed in the Temple of Ephesus in 350 BC. Now, later on, the trend caught on, and it was the Romans who actually managed to apply it on a larger scale, from their temples to their homes of the super wealthy, of course, all the way to public baths and to government buildings. Now, the hypocaust was created by making a structure just beneath the floor of a building. And this structure would consist of pillars that would raise the structure's floor. Now, on top of these pillars would be tiles that were covered with a layer of concrete. Above it is the floor of the building itself. Now, a furnace would then be lit, and the combination of hot air and smoke would rise and be trapped in the space between the floors to heat the multiple levels of the building. The smoke would find its way through a series of clay flues that act as pipes. What's even more ingenious about how the Romans used the hypocaust is that they built bronze ventilators that could be used to regulate the temperatures. Now, if the system sounds too labor-intensive and expensive, that's because it was. They said that slave laborers would have to constantly maintain the fire at just the right temperature and the right level of comfort for people in the building or home. But still, I mean, that's pretty amazing that all the way back then, you know, you're talking 350 BC, the Greeks had figured out how to do this central heating of the building with the smoke and everything. I mean, that's pretty cool. It reminds me of a ski trip I took to Colorado one time where it had heated floors, but it wasn't smoke or hot air. It was like hot water that would move through the tiles or just under the floor to heat the floor, you know? Pretty cool. It's something that you never really think of until you have it. And when I was there, I was like, whoa, this makes a big difference. I can walk around barefoot and it's not so cold out, you know? Pretty ingenious. Now, this next one, everybody's pretty familiar with this, I think, but it has to be mentioned here. When it comes to ancient technology and something way ahead of its time, you have to talk about the Antikythera device. Now, I first read about the Antikythera device in the late, great Philip Coppens' book. This was years ago, and actually, I didn't get to speak to him. Cam spoke to Philip Coppens just before he got ill, and unfortunately, he passed away due to cancer, but we were going to have him on our show just before he got ill. And I wish we would have been able to do that. That would have been, another feather to stick in our cap. He was an amazing writer and author. But this guy, Philip Coppens, he was writing about this stuff long before the television series, you know, Ancient Aliens. And now, he wasn't just a proponent for the ancient alien theory, but he was writing and documenting all these advances in these primitive cultures. Well, that they're not primitive, but what we think of as primitive compared to us. When I don't think that they were. I mean, he was talking about these things. And the Antikythera device, this was recovered in a shipwreck back in 1901. And this Antikythera mechanism was among several other heavily crusted artifacts that were salvaged from the sea. And the mechanism is of particular interest because of its complicated construction, I would say. Taking years of research by experts and studies about Babylonian records on eclipses, it was later confirmed that this Antikythera mechanism was the world's first computer. It looks like a bunch of gears and things on it. It looks like if you were to take an old Swiss watch, you know, with all the gears where you can see it inside, but then blow it up on a massive scale. So I'm saying something like the size of a hula hoop almost. The mechanism features a fixed ring dial on its front face that is called the ecliptic, or the 12 zodiac signs that are equally marked off on 30-degree sectors. And its construction closely resembles the Babylonian method of assigning 1/12 of the ecliptic to each sign, despite the fact that constellation boundaries were quite variable. Now, outside of the ring dial, the device equally features a rotating ring that marks the days and months of the Egyptian calendar. Now, this Antikythera mechanism closely resembles a modern-day clock, a large circular face on the front of it, and a knob on its side which manipulates winding parts. And when the knob is turned, at least 7 different clock hands, one for the moon, one for the sun, and 5 for the 5 planets that the Greeks were able to see, they would move and display the celestial time. Now, not only did the device show which stars rose and set on a given date, but also the phases of the moon. It was an extremely complicated device, and even though its pieces have been given clues and ideas of how it worked, experts can only guess as to how it was put together, with its highly intricate system of gears inside. And see, that's the biggest mystery. Is not only were they aware of the phases of the moon and of the sun and of the planets, they were actually put together in this one machine, and it was, you know, it's accurate. So there's many levels of complexity of this thing, because not only did they have a fine understanding of these celestial bodies, but they also were able to put it together in this device. That's why they call it a computer. You know, a computer is not like you think of it, but a simple computer, something that's able to do calculations on a massive scale. And they don't know how this thing was made or who made it. But if they were actually able to do this, you know, this is something they found in the Mediterranean Sea. The question is, if they were able to do this, what else were they capable of? Like, what other computers were they building? Is this just a one-off? I doubt it. I mean, I'm sure that they were making other things, maybe even wristwatches, you know, like we talked about the Swiss pocket watch or something. Maybe they were making watches. Maybe they're making clocks on the wall. Who knows what they were making? But if they were able to do this, I'm certain that they were doing other things. I mean, I've even seen where the Chinese had invented a device, like a seismic device that was able to detect when earthquakes were going to happen. You know, there's lots of things that these ancient cultures were producing that were at a very high level of technology. And I don't think we give them enough credit. Here's another one. This comes all the way back from 1 AD, and it's about, you take it for granted when you go to a grocery store or something, but automatic opening doors. They were able to build this all the way back in 1 AD. Now, of course, they weren't as fast as the ones we have in modern day because of electricity and stuff. But what's the most striking aspect of these ancient Greeks' automatic doors is the fact that it wasn't until 1931 that the automatic doors that we're familiar with today were even created. Now, these doors that existed in ancient Greece were clearly hundreds of years before their time, and they were used only very sparingly due to the cost and the time it required. That isn't to say that the automatic doors created by Heron of Alexandria were all that practical. They were a marvel to the people of ancient Greece, but they were not something that could have been used on a home or most public buildings. In fact, it would take hours for the doors even to open once the process was started. And this meant that the doors could only be opened like once a day. Now, to open the doors, a fire would be lit in order to generate heat. And the heat would cause the atmospheric pressure to build up in a brass vessel. And this vessel would then pump water into a large holding containers. And these holding containers would then function as weights to open the door. This sort of hydraulic system would have been awe-inspiring for those who would see a door open on its own right before them. Now, there were two main applications for this type of door. The first was for the temple. Priests would be the ones to light the fires and keep them going to have the doors opening at the exact time that the people would be showing up for prayer. There is also evidence that Heron developed a similar system to open the gates to the city. But nonetheless, they created these automatic opening doors long before we did here in the modern world. But let's move on to another part of the world. There were not just advanced cultures in the Middle East, Mesopotamia, Greece, and Egypt. No. Remember, we talked about this earlier. There were several advanced cultures at the same time located at different places around the globe. While at the same time, there were very simple hunter-gatherer cultures coexisting. Let's cross the ocean to South and Central America, deep within the Amazon jungle, and I mean deep. You have to remember how vast the Amazon jungle must have been before all the deforestation that has taken place over the last 150 years. This place was huge and very remote, yet there were several advanced cultures still thriving there. What if I told you that a group of natives located deep within the Amazon jungle actually developed a crude wireless radio communication system long before what we call the modern world? Seems crazy, right? Now, I don't think that ancient aliens gave them this information. No, that's something that Giorgio Tsoukalos might say on television. I think that people are very resourceful and come up with extraordinary things on their own. First, let's talk about the man that discovered this tribe and how this discovery came about. For most of you, you probably have never heard of the name James Campbell Beasley. Sure, you've heard of Percy Fawcett and his search for the lost city of Z, but not Beasley. Beasley was a mostly obscure British hunter and explorer who was born in London in 1874 and eventually educated at Eton in Oxford, who, despite his relatively unknown nature, had a rather colorful life. He had a very busy life, traveling all over to places like Australia, South Africa, and he was actually in a war there. He spent time mining gold and silver, all over from South Africa to Mexico to even the Klondike. He was an explorer, a miner, and even an athlete. He and his team actually won the Pacific Coast Polo Open in Southern California back in 1913. Well, sometime after all of his travels and mining and stuff, he decided he wasn't done and wanted to mount a large expedition to the Amazon jungle. He started his journey from New York to Peru in 1913 to raft nearly 4,000 miles from Lima along it all the way from its source to the Atlantic Ocean over the course of 5 months down the Amazon River and make a myriad of amazing discoveries in the uncharted wilderness along the way. As Besley and his expedition rafted down the Amazon River through remote, unexplored, and untamed rainforest, they certainly met a lot of challenges. First, the god-awful heat. The humidity. You could only imagine. The terrible insects like bullet ants. And of course, mosquitoes. Yes, he and most of the members of his expedition, they all contracted malaria, as well as a few other tropical diseases. If that wasn't bad enough, there were dangerous predators and snakes. And most of all, other tribes. Some were man-eating headhunters. But there were several good things Besley and his team were able to discover. They were able to capture and film, for the first time, footage of the ruins at Machu Picchu, which had been discovered just 2 years prior by a Professor Hiram Bingham of Yale University. They were also able to discover the lost Incan cities buried in the overground tendrils of the jungles of Cusco. When Besley returned to New York, he did so with a cache of numerous rare artifacts from the jungle, lost tribes, and even from the decomposed bodies of less successful explorers he had come across sprawled out in the wilderness, along with his prized footage of the journey and, of course, Machu Picchu. Everything seemed to be going great for Besley, and his astounding journey was widely publicized in the media at the time. Yet, sadly, all of the important items he had brought back, as well as the footage, were promptly stolen in New York. Now, Besley, when he heard of this, well, as you could imagine, he was devastated. You have to imagine, this is not like doing a long trip today, where you just flew back to New York after spending a couple weeks on vacation or holiday in Bora Bora. No. He had to sail from New York to Peru. Then, he had to raft 4,000 miles down the Amazon River over 5 months, and then sail back to New York, all the while overcoming malaria and losing several of his colleagues, only to have everything stolen in New York. But Besley was a determined man. I guess most great explorers are. So he decided to do the whole journey all over again, reshooting all of his footage as closely to the original as possible, and gathering even more relics this time, including two full mummies. With the shadow of some sort of sinister bad luck seemingly hanging over him, his ship, the Metapon, was almost sunk in New York Harbor after crashing into another vessel. The relics and the footage were somehow able to be saved. Two films would be made about the dashing expedition. The first one was called The Captain Besley Expedition in 1914, and the other one was In the Amazon Jungles with the Captain Besley Expedition in 1915. Besides all of the groundbreaking new footage and interesting items Besley brought back with him, there was also a rather strange curiosity of a tale that he relayed. He noticed during his expedition that the natives of the Amazon always seemed to know when he was coming, no matter how far or how fast he traveled, which piqued Besley's curiosity to no end. According to a 1915 book called The Artisans and Artifacts of Vanished Races by Theophilus L. Dickerson, as well as the 1916 article in the publication Wireless World, when Besley inquired as to how the natives so quickly knew of his arrival without error, the locals explained that the natives of the region had long ago developed a complex system of communicating instantaneously from miles around, essentially a wireless system, of which Besley himself would later write in his journal. This is what he said. It was in the Wamara region that we first learned of this wireless system. We were met
at the entrance of the village by a number of natives. They had evidently been expecting us, and when we asked how they knew that we were coming, they pointed to a crude-looking arrangement suspended between two tree stumps on a horizontal bar. Through our Indian interpreter, we learned that it was a wireless apparatus for sending and receiving messages from the various tribes throughout the Amazon Valley. The transmitter was a hollowed trunk of a tree suspended from the pole so that the base was slightly off the ground. Inside it had been arranged very much like our own violins. It was explained that when the instrument was struck smartly with a small rubber hammer, a vibration was created that carried for miles over the hills. The receiver is very similar to the transmitter, except that it is placed on a hardwood platform, the base of the hollow tree trunk being grounded on the platform. When the message is struck in the neighboring village, sometimes 30 miles away, this receiver catches the vibrations, causing a jerky singing sound. I understand that the sound system can be read by the members of the tribe, and that it is in this way news of victories and other happenings are told throughout the countryside. In this way, the Indians all along our route heralded our approach, and we were met by the inhabitants all through the Putumayo, Napo, Beni, and Madre de Dios, and lower Ucayali valleys, the tributaries to the great Amazon. We learned also from the Marathos that the Huambesos tribes, that this method of telegraphy has been used by the various tribes in that district for thousands of years. So, this is very impressive if true, which I believe it is. I mean, why not? The question is, how? How did these primitive cultures develop a wireless communication system thousands of years before the concept first caught on? The truth is, I don't know. How does anyone ever come up with anything? How did the Chinese come up with gunpowder? How did German Johannes Gutenberg come up with the printing press? What about the compass, the steam engine, flight, vaccination, penicillin, rockets, nuclear fission, the personal computer, and of course, the internet? People come up with life-altering inventions all of the time, so why not long ago? I think when we think of the past, to these remote villages deep within the dark jungles or forest, we think of the people there as being simple-minded, as a group of people somehow beneath our level of intelligence. But I think it's time we change the way we think. I think people then, as well as now, are no less intelligent than you and me. Definitely more intelligent than me. When I look at the ancient calendars, the herbal medicines, as well as intricate understandings of the cosmic calendar, and what I mean is the accurate predictions of the seasons, as well as the processions of the equinoxes, eclipses, and summer and winter solstices, you have to wonder, what other incredible inventions did they come up with that we simply don't know about? Things that have been forever lost to the sands of time. I don't know. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Man, I'm still thinking about the cephalopods. Well, I'm going to be thinking about that for weeks. Because I've often, you know, you take Luke to the zoo or the Dallas World Aquarium, downtown Dallas has an incredible exhibit there, and they have a little section where they have a cephalopod there. I think it's called the cuttlefish.
Yeah.
And
that was your nickname in school, wasn't it?
The cuttlefish of Cthulhu, right?
Right.
They kind of just sit there and they look like they're hovering, and you can look into their eyes. And man, you know that thing's looking at you like, What are you doing?
I think I'm going to get a cephalopod tattoo. I've got koi and sharks. I think I'm going to go ahead
get, like,
and get
the,
one.
The Kraken, right? Where it's like taking over a ship.
Well, that's what I'm going to get on my back. That was my game plan, is what I want to put on my back.
Oh, yeah?
A full back piece, yeah.
Or the actual Kraken from like
the actual Kraken
Clash of the
from
Titans,
Clash of
the
old
like
school
got four
one.
Arms.
Yeah, the old school. Nah, I'm going to get like a giant squid or something like that. Yeah. Look, before we look, I got to read this to you because you've talked about this numerous times and you talk about the cephalopods. And it ties into this. Christian Hauser from futurism.com wrote this, and it says, "Our bodies aren't built to have babies on Mars."
Yeah, that's no shock, right?
So let's alter our DNA. Now listen to this. Having a baby on Earth is not always fun because morning sickness, this, that, and the other. It says having a baby on Mars, though, might be downright impossible unless we're willing to rework our DNA. It says that this news comes courtesy of a new study published in Futures by researchers from the University of Information Technology and Management in Poland. Goes on to say that let's review the two main issues with procreation on the red planet. One is radiation. Because Mars' atmosphere is so thin, cosmic radiation poses a threat to any humans on its surface and any human fetuses. The researchers note this could cause problems in fetal development. Settlers will also experience increased exposure to cosmic radiation during their journey to Mars, which could affect their ability to procreate. Radiation is known to be deleterious for adults and especially for reproductive cells, developing embryos and fetuses, and is already considered a major health hazard to astronauts, is what the researchers actually wrote. And then other one, part two here, is microgravity. Exposure to microgravity, both during the trip and once on the red planet, is another concern. We already know it can cause bone loss and affect the levels of fluids in the eyes and spinal cords of astronauts, leading to vision loss. Add in a number of other potential health issues associated with space travel. Nervous system changes, hearing loss, this, that, and the other. And the human body is hardly in peak condition for reproduction on Mars. So what are two human settlers of Mars to do if they want to start their family? It says here they might want to tweak their DNA to be less than a little less human. In their paper, the researchers note the possibility of using of CRISPR to genetically engineer humans to overcome these hurdles to reproduction. This would result in speciation of Homo sapiens, essentially a new type of human, which opens up an entirely new set of ethical issues that the world will have to wrestle with. Says still it's not likely that we'll be making, you know, trying to make reproduction on Mars happen tomorrow. Says we have, of course, plenty of this stuff. And they go into talking about we have to get there first and all that. But it goes into what you and I have talked about. You can't reproduce up there the way we do everything. Now, you can go through the physical act.
Sure.
But it's not, you're not going to be able to carry the baby, and it's not going to work out the way it normally. But now listen to this.
That's what I'm thinking, that people don't ever, they look at it as a logistics problem. Like, if we could just figure out how to get there, then we'll be scot-free. When in actuality, you're built to live here, and that's it.
It would be the same way as trying to get to the bottom of the ocean and just establish life down there. It's going to be different.
Yeah.
Things are different. But when they started talking about CRISPR, it started making me think, and I haven't seen it yet, but it seems like it's the premise behind the special, the Netflix original Titan, where they're trying to, like, alter his DNA for deep space travel.
I haven't seen
that. So that's, yet again, the minute you alter your DNA, you're no longer a human.
Right.
And you know that's gonna happen. Become an alien. And if you leave, so that's where it goes.
You know that in the future, if not super rich are already doing it, that people are going to be manipulating their DNA. They're going to be ripped. They're going to have whatever. You're going to pick the color eyes you want your kid to have.
But would you alter your DNA if you knew that it would take out any chance of heart disease or cancer?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Exactly. So that's the kind of, that's the way I see it. I don't think of it as being where they're going to all be superhumans at first. I don't think it's going to be something until, I think it's going to be health related. That they're going to be like,
yeah.
I'll tell you this. It seems like it runs in my, you know, and you always hear, oh, it runs in your family. It runs in your family. It seems like my wife's family has a run of bad knees. Everybody in there has up having knee surgery of some sort. Something like, if you could just change one little thing in your DNA sequence to where everybody born after this date had good knees, well, then you would do it to where everybody now. So I think it's going to be somewhere where there's, but you think of the repercussions. If everybody could fix their knees, there's no more knee doctors, no more knee surgery, there's no more knee braces. The same way with your eyes. If nobody needed glasses for the rest of their lives because you could easily fix it, where do those workers go? I mean, there's little bitty things, little ripples make big effects. So it's a lot of stuff like that could change. I could see, but I would, if I could change things for health-wise, like, look, I don't want to live forever.
No.
Because it's the threat of death that makes you work harder. That's what they always talk about. It makes you enjoy it because you know it's going
to
run out.
When I was about 25, I would have liked to have been bitten by a vampire, a vampire, so I could remain 25 for a long time because that would be fun.
You don't want to remain like you are now?
No, no. Much younger, more energy.
Yeah,
and then a couple hundred years, then I would just, you know, I'm going to go out in the sun today.
And check out. Yeah.
Or I could be like, maybe I could be one of the cool vampires that just sparkles. But what I wouldn't be doing is trying to conjure up, you know, love affairs with high school people.
Now, that's a lie. That's a lie. That's a lie in itself.
Yeah.
For those of you that aren't elitist, you've already missed some crazy rants, and he almost went on one right there again.
Oh, no.
You've got to really, man, he's really been worked up here lately. So.
I think it's the hot weather, man. It's getting straight. In fact, I'm getting really amped up for the Stephen Wonderboy Thompson versus Darren Till fights this weekend.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The rest of the card's not too good. I think Neil Magny's fighting somebody, but...
But Neil Magny just got put on the card. Like, he just stepped up, so he's taking it on like a handful of days' notice.
But Darren Till and Wonderboy, and I can't believe that they're making that fight for free.
And here's what I can't believe. I can't believe that they're putting them up against each other already.
Yeah, right.
Like, both of them, you know, now I understand Wonderboy. And I understand Darren Till. I mean, Darren Till, you know, he worked over Cowboy, the whole thing. But, I mean, like, these are two guys, and I don't know. I just don't know if I agree with it being so quick already. I'd like to see. But it's not like I don't think either one's ready. I'm just mean, like.
I'm going to take Till. I think Till's going to win. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go with you. I'm going to see.
I think Steven's a good fighter. We've seen this so many times where when they have a bad outing, everybody kind of picks up on it.
Yeah.
And they have a hard time coming back. I think it's going to be a real tough fight.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a good fight. And then I know that coming up, I know you're getting ready for this. The CM Punk versus Mike Jackson fight, that's coming up in like a couple weeks.
I will say this. I listened to Robin Black on Joe Rogan's podcast when they did the whole breakdown. And Robin points out something really, really good. He's like, this fight interests me more than anything else. More than it should. And here's why. Because that fight's actually going to be on the pay-per-view card.
I know, it's actually the first one.
It's the first one, which is crazy as it sounds.
The main card, yep.
The reason it's interesting is because going into the very first fight CM Punk had, everybody knew he was going to get destroyed except him.
I like when he walked out.
Yeah.
I'm like, does he know that this isn't a wrestling? Like, this isn't
fake.
This isn't choreographed.
And I'm not hating on it. I'm just saying it's not, when fake, I mean, is it's not pre-planned.
Mickey Gall's, I mean,
Yeah.
Well, you saw what happened. I will say this. What's his real name's not CM Punk.
You don't need to worry about his
real
name.
It's like Boyles or something like that.
Yeah.
But I will give him this. The guy didn't go away. I mean, he could have easily went and found something else. Well, I'm going to take up surfing or I'm
going to
take up.
That's what they're getting at.
I mean, he at least went back to the gym, has gone through working out, and then is giving it another go. You know, when somebody, it's not when you fail, it's how you pick yourself up again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but also.
So I got to give him respect because he's coming back in there. I still don't think it's going to be good for him.
This fight's way more on his level.
The Mike Jackson got or whatever?
Yeah, it's way more on his level. And CM Punk also lost, and like Robin points out, the most embarrassing way possible is he was completely just and utterly destroyed.
I don't know, James Toney, he got put out pretty quick.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, Randy just Smith singled him, took him down, put him away. Speaking of that, too.
That card, it's UFC 225. That's a stacked card. Forrest Whitaker's fighting.
Yes.
Andre Arlovsky's going to be on there. Man.
Forrest Whitaker. He's not fighting, is he?
I'm not Forrest.
He's way too old. He's got that lazy eye.
I'm sorry, Robert Whitaker.
I'm like, what are you talking about?
Watched Black Panther. That's all I was thinking of it.
I'm like, he had better be careful.
Versus Yoel Romero. But, man, this is a fight I don't want to see. Overeem versus Curtis Blades.
No. Yeah. Although, I don't know, though. Curtis Blades, if Overeem can come back.
No, that's what I'm saying. I think Overeem needs to go find something else to do.
Yeah, but Curtis Blades is dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Guida's fighting down that night. Sergio Pettis. It's going to be, it's action-packed. I can't wait for that one.
And we got one of our listeners, Dustin. He's a wrestler. And I mean, like, flying through the, he's a big guy, too. If you look at him on Instagram flying through the air, I'm like, dude, be careful. Because he posted some pictures the other day of like blood running down out of his elbow or something. I'm like, dude, be careful. That's another thing. Like, I do like to, I was a huge, like, WWE wrestling fan as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
I don't see how guys that size fly through the air.
I don't either.
Because, look, I don't care if it's choreographed or not. You can't choreograph gravity.
Did you watch the HBO documentary on Andre the Giant?
Greatest documentary I've seen sports-related in years.
It was good. Very
yeah.
good.
Yeah. That one and Ric Flair. Those two are great.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Woo!
Colby Covington. I mean, this guy loves to talk trash, right? He's fighting Rafael Dos Anjos. I mean...
I don't want to be that guy, but I don't think Covington's got what it takes to beat Dos Anjos.
I don't know, but you know the trash talking's going to be on another level, right?
It better be, because it needs to. He's going to have to do something to try to meet Javier's level of game.
Could you imagine if it was in Brazil?
They can't. They would kill him.
Yeah,
they would kill him. You think the Brazilians hated Chael Sonnen?
Yeah, right.
They will kill Colby.
Yeah.
Like, there's no getting away from that.
I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to the baseball tournament this weekend.
We're going to Waco.
We're going to Waco. And I don't know why I'm pausing here. I'm reading this. This feed is coming in across my computer screen.
You're just still
got,
hung
I'm
up
like
on
a bass.
It.
I got caught by something. I'm like, what is that?
You're like, there's more fight news? What's this?
Well, it's talking about the UFC that'll be on ESPN.
Yeah, starting in January of 19.
They've gathered them up. I wonder how that's going to change the landscape of the sport. Because for a while...
You think they're going to keep Reebok?
No, I don't. I don't know when that expires. But I'm wondering... You know, what parts of it are going to be on ESPN and what parts of it are going to be on pay-per-view? Like, how are they going to move it around?
That's a really... I need to look into that and see. I do know this, that what they bought, ESPN, it's a five-year deal that they bought, and that it's a $1.5 billion package that they bought from the UFC.
I know, but I kind of feel like they're kind of late to the party. Like, I feel almost that ESPN should have done this 6 years ago. Because to me...
Yeah.
I think the UFC was running better 6 years ago than it is today.
Well, here's what's kind of an odd thing. It's a five-year thing, right? Five-year deal.
Yeah.
They're only going to broadcast 30 UFC events, but that's per year.
Yeah.
Realize per 30 a year. I'm like, they're going to be on ESPN. It's going to be fights every night.
Pretty much already is that way.
That's true.
I know that people are like people that aren't in the fighting. They're like, what are we listening to? Why is this show talking about the UFC?
I can't help it. It's my favorite
thing. I can't help it. Sorry, folks. Got into it. But yeah, man. I'm going to be down in Waco. Cam and his family are going to come down there. It's going to be hot. It's going to be fun. Hopefully we do well. And Monday's Memorial Day. So no work. No work for you, huh? No work for you?
No work for me.
No work for me. The kids got 1 week of school left, and then it's going to be summertime, so it's going to be hard to get my day job done because most of the time I work from home, and the house is empty. But once school's out, I'm going to get interruptions. I'm going to have to get an office space somewhere, but I'm going to have to wait for the show to make more money. So everybody out there, stay out of trouble. Till next time, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hill.
Peace, y'all.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.